Joining us now on The Debate, Mary Ballantyne. She's executive director of the Ontario Association of Children's Aid Societies. Ian Underwood, member of the Commission to Promote Sustainable Child Welfare, and herself an adoptive parent. Will Falk, executive fellow with the Mowat Centre, and himself a foster and adoptive parent. Arthur Gallant, a former Crown Ward. And, of course, we welcome back Shanna Allen from the Youth Leaving Care Hearings. Good to have you all around the table to continue with the discussion that I started with Shanna a few moments ago. Let's start, though, with some of the numbers. And, Michael, if you would, let's bring these up. The province, as a parent, here we go. There are 17,000 as the number of children in care of the Children's Aid Societies in the province of Ontario. 8,300 is the number of children for whom the province of Ontario is their legal guardian. The province is their parent. 2,770 children are in care, living independently, some as young as 16. We've got more. When the province is your parent, 44%, just 44% of youth in care graduate from high school. That compares to 81% of the general population which graduates from high school. 68% of homeless youth have come from foster homes, group homes, and/or a youth center, and 71% of homeless youth have had previous criminal justice involvement. Being a Crown Ward, I guess we can conclude here, is not a heck of a lot of fun sometimes. Mary, let's start with you. Shanna's really turned her life around, and I want to know how representative her story is in terms of its trending towards a happy ending for the young people in this province today.
Well, unfortunately, Shanna's story isn't everyone's story. But there are a surprising number of young people who are amazingly resilient and have stories that are not dissimilar to Shanna's, who are able to turn their lives around.
They go through hell, though, don't they?
They do. They have, well, the reason that they're involved with the Children's Aid Society is because something, and quite often many things, have not gone well for them. So then you put that on top of not being in your own home, not being with your own family, and being in a system that has many checks and balances for good reasons, but isn't a regular, normal setting for children to grow up in. So you put that together, and it's difficult.
What's been your impression of the hearings that they've been holding?
I think they have done an outstanding job. I think it's been great to hear the youth, and what has been really impressive is the youth taking charge of this on their own, and that day having the number of them that were there organizing it, running the panel, asking the questions, the maturity that they showed in their presentations, the maturity that they showed in their responses, I think we should be very proud of them.
Great. Ian, you were at the hearings?
I was indeed.
What was your impression?
I was going to echo the same thing, and I think that was part of the buzz among the adults at the hearings of just it really reaffirmed for us and reminded us of the insight, the thoughtfulness, and the wisdom that can and is coming from our youth. So it was, there were adults that spoke at it as well, but it was just very affirming of what inspired the hearings in the first place, to have hearings about youth and by youth, because nothing can replace, you know, that kind of voice. On our side as adults, we're not close enough to the experience, and most of us haven't lived the kind of experience that the youth talked to us about over the last 2 weeks.
Let's hear more of that voice then. I know your name's Arthur, but everybody calls you AJ, so I will too, okay?
Okay.
AJ, you were at these hearings.
I actually spoke at the
hearings. You spoke at the hearings. What did you tell people?
I told people about the issues that we're facing. I spoke about a number of topics. I think the biggest thing that I'd spoke of was feeling like I was abandoned as soon as I turned 18.
Go back a bit, though. How was it that you came to be a Crown Ward in the first place?
I became a Crown Ward. I was born to a single parent. My father had left my mother before I was born and lost touch with my mother. And my mother is mentally disabled and was unable to take care of me. So my grandmother stepped up to the plate and helped my mom raise me. When I was 5 years old, my grandmother ended up getting Alzheimer's and ended up spending a good portion in hospitals and ended up going into a nursing home. So what ended up happening was my mom just realized it was too much responsibility helping take care of not only my grandmother in her final years, but also a growing son.
So what happened to you?
I was put into the care of Children's Aid Society because my mom felt like that was the best option for me.
And where did you end up going to live then?
16 different group homes and foster homes over a period of 9 years, all across Ontario.
It's really, I'm sure, easy to get that family feeling when you've lived in 16 different places over 9 years, right?
Oh, you betcha. No, absolutely not. A definite big topic that we were talking about was that we lack a sense of belonging. Especially when you're being bounced around from home to home, I think that was a topic that came up a lot during the hearings, was a lot of youth were feeling like we're being shipped around, that we were, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but almost feeling like a parcel. And what ends up happening is you lose your sense of belonging because you're with these strangers. And, you know, the foster parents don't make you feel like you're one of their own, nor do their own biological children, nor do the other foster children who've already established a sense of belonging in the home. And you feel like a visitor, even if you're in a placement for several months or several years.
Let me get Will in at this point. Will, you've been on this program before as the, you know, the policy guy, but this is personal for you. Mm-hmm. You've done this. Mm-hmm. You've adopted.
Yeah.
How come?
My wife and I felt that it was a way of having children in our lives and giving something back at the same time.
You did foster parenting as well?
Yeah, we did foster parenting both in the U.S. and in Canada, and adopted both of our sons, one in the U.S. And one in Canada. And
do you know whether the backgrounds of any of the foster kids that you've dealt with were as dramatic and difficult as what we've heard today?
I think you can generally say that kids who come into care because one or more bad things have happened, and certainly the dozens of kids that I've known, either directly or through other foster parents, have all had similar stories. And they're tough stories. I mean, I don't think that anyone is capricious about bringing kids into care. When kids come into care, there's a reason.
Mm-hmm. Now, AJ didn't tell us this, but I know this because I read his speech to the committee, and that was he had some real troubles in his background in terms of his own personal behavior. You know, he got, as he said, shipped all over the place, and his reaction was to lash out at everybody, and I think that's probably not very surprising. As a foster parent, how do you kind of deal with all that?
I remember one of the things that I did in foster training in the U.S. was they tried to dramatize it for us as foster parents. They said, take everything that's important to you and write it down on 5 or 6 cue cards, and then take those cue cards and tear them up. And imagine what that feels like. And, you know, right after something bad has happened to you that causes you to be taken away from your biological parents, you're then put in with a group of people in a world that you have no idea about. The struggle to make that permanent is very, very difficult. And I think it's something that people on all sides in the system try to do a good job at, really work hard at, but it is not an easy thing. It is not an easy situation.
So, AJ, from a policy point of view, when you turn 18, we understand from having heard from Shanna, you know, the clock stops in many respects,
absolutely,
right? What do you think the government ought to do to kind of, from a policy point of view, change that clocking, the stopping of the clock, if you will?
One thing that I had mentioned in my testimony at the Youth Leaving Care hearings and what I'm currently advocating for in a variety of forums is there needs to be a transition period. The clock shouldn't stop at 18. I'm not in a position to advocate and to put a new number saying the clock stops at 21 or 25, but those are numbers that I'm hearing from professionals in the field, but also from other Crown wards that I've talked to. There needs to be a transition period because your entire time in care, there's all this structure. Right up until I turned 18, someone was telling me every day to make my bed. Someone was implementing a schedule from the time I woke up in the morning till the time I go to bed. And I'm sure these other adults in the room here can say, this isn't exactly how you live your lives. Adults always have some sort of structure, but it's not structured to the minute. And I felt like they needed to kind of, help me loosen the structure, but also tell me how to be a functioning adult.
So encourage your independence.
Encourage my independence, but also in terms of money, because I had everything paid for in this system. And I had a lot of great services that I currently miss. But I think what needs to be implemented is a system in which youth are also somewhat financially accountable.
Let me ask Shan about that. Do you have kind of the basics of financial literacy well understood?
I would say not in all aspects, no. I would say, I think that what's really important is that they're almost, they create, it's like a sense of parenting. Like, when you're 18, you don't call up your daughter, or I don't know if you have sons and daughters, but you wouldn't say goodbye, never talk to you again, good luck on the rest of your life. You would somehow, you know, teach them how to become adults, and then maybe help them with their tuition or help them with support, like medical and dental, those kinds of things most 18-year-olds don't have to worry about. And I know that stats show that most people aren't really independent until the age of around 27. So to expect us who have been through all these challenges in our childhood, that at 18, we're going to be completely capable to go out on our own, or at 21, say, you know what, you had a good run at it, but now you're on your own.
An example that I was giving to some of my friends recently was that if, you know, friends that are my age, 21, 22, if they default on a credit card payment, for example, their parents might offer them a bailout. Even though I currently live with my biological mother, I'm not offered that bailout. If I get drunk, you know, at Young and Blue or at 3 in the morning and, you know, need a bailout, no one's there to bail me out, but other people my age who have parents, you know, and who never really went through the system, their parents will offer that bailout. My parent can't do that because my parent is a province, not a person.
Mary, let's help us understand why it is this way. Why is it when you turn 18, suddenly the province goes like this, washes its hands of you?
Well, I don't really think I can answer why, because I think the system has evolved over many years, and this is where it currently is. Certainly, there have been things that have moved along over the last many years. I remember when I started 20 years ago that there was no support at all for youth that are 18. Now there is support for youth between the ages of 18 and 21. And in fact,
to go to school, you mean?
To go to school. And in fact, actually, there's even more of a policy change just in the works so that kids don't actually have to be in school to be able to get that support to 21. So there has been an evolution of support, but there are some areas that are really still quite striking that I think we all need to work together to figure out. And one of them is that right now the policy would say that when a youth becomes 18, they're no longer able to stay in foster care. And for many kids, and I have, as I said at the youth hearings, I have 3 children between the ages of 18 and 22. So I totally get what it's like to get a phone call and have to bail out my child at some point for something that happens to all kids as they're growing up. So we do need to find a way to have that policy be more inclusive of our kids so they can stay in foster care. And the other one is that at the age of 21, they're quite right, there are no systems, there's not money available, the youth really are cut off, and unless they have a social worker who's decided to stay with them on a voluntary sort of basis, they really don't have those supports. And many of these kids, like Shanna, and I'm sorry to call you kids, but they're just like my kids,
but we still
right?
We feel like children because we don't feel like we've had the
right.
opportunity to
well,
grow up.
Well, you are our kids. You're the province's kids, and you're like my own kids. You know, that age, you're still kids,
but
and we shouldn't...
Help me understand this more, Will. How is it that somehow the province decided in its wisdom that at 18, that's it, they were done?
I'm going to take the same position that Mary does on the why question. I think that it's over time we've developed the system, but there are clearly some things that we can do to really make a difference. One is we've begun moving towards having more permanency earlier. So the province has, through Bill 179 recently and through some added funding, helped to make it a bit easier for kids who are in stable foster situations to become adopted. So, Shan, I don't know the particulars about your case, but in a situation where you're in a long-term foster placement, there are actually barriers in the system to converting that to an adoption. So you could make it a permanent situation, but the state, in its wisdom, has until quite recently reacted to that by taking away some or all of your funding that you were receiving. So there's actually a negative, there's actually a barrier there.
Just explain that. If you're a foster parent, you do get a stipend from the province to help these kids.
Right. And in the U.S. now, it is the norm that that stipend continues for older kids who are adopted. In Canada, in Ontario, that has not been the case in many situations. Now, there have been some great CASs that have stepped up and done it anyways. But as we heard when we were doing our expert panel report, it's clear that they're doing it against their economic interests, and that should not be the case.
No, it's the same scenario with kinship, though.
Yeah, right. Please go ahead.
No, and for the viewers that aren't familiar with what kinship is, what CAS will sometimes do is look for a suitable family member to put the child or youth with. But what ends up happening, though, is that if CAS were to put that child with a foster family, the foster family would receive the stipend, but not the extended family. Hmm. And that tends to be a bit of an issue.
So we should change that policy, too.
Absolutely, because, you know, kids aren't cheap these days. And and I think it's better for youth that they stay with, even if it's an extended family member. But sometimes the extended family member isn't ready or isn't able to take on the financial responsibilities of the youth.
Yeah. Ian, you wanted to say.
Well, I was going to. So there's a lot of storylines that we're on now, and I think let's stick with the funding one for a moment, because funding is always part of, whether it's in our own families or in the government as a family, how do we make decisions about what we can do for kids? So as Will has said, and this is something the Commission's done a lot of thinking about, how can we look at how CASs are funded and make sure that they have the latitude to make the choices that make the most sense for each kid? So today the situation is, and Will was saying this, CASs do have more of a financial incentive to keep a kid in foster care than to move a kid into a permanency situation, even with the same family.
So we have perverse incentives in the system.
And no one's comfortable calling them that, but it does add up to that. And again, CASs are coming from the same place as all of us. They want to do the right things for kids, but they also are spending time worrying about how do they make sure the money they have next year is going to be enough for next year. And so because right now the funding is a bit organized around what was last year's funding and last year's volume, CASs are trying to keep that in place, as opposed to part of where the commission is coming from and advising is having funding that is based on the needs in and allocated based in needs in the communities, untying the hands of the CASs so that they can make decisions for the Shannas, the AJs, the kids that they're working with.
Let me get Mary to speak to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, for sure, the funding and how it should be allocated is always a tricky piece. And
would you agree there are perverse incentives in the system?
I would agree that there are parts of the system that make it very difficult to move forward on some of these pieces. And as Will was saying, some CASs do go ahead and make that work anyway, but it does make it often difficult for them to figure out how they're going to pay some of their other bills. So certainly looking at some of those funding issues so that we can move ahead on some of these pieces. But the other funding piece is that for children between the ages of 21 or up to about, well, anything over the age of 21, there's actually no funding at all. Mm-hmm. And that, as you've heard, is definitely a group that could use more than just a change to our current funding mechanism.
Mm-hmm. There is a fair amount of money in the system. Where I think we need to start is where you started the segment, which is on outcomes, right? We know that we have bad outcomes or less good outcomes. We know that they're graduating at half the rate. We know that we have increased homelessness. We know that there are criminal justice costs. These are our kids, and we are parenting them, and we have to take that responsibility. That means that we should know immediately what their grades are, we should know their health status, we should know all the basics, and we should know that through the age of majority and past. And then, as Ian and Mary have both said, you know, we need to give our people in the field the tools to move the money around a bit. In some ways, Steve, it's not dissimilar to healthcare in that way, right? I mean, with those 8,300 kids, that's all we're talking about. If we could focus in the efforts and really make a commitment here, whether it's more permanency or more funding later in life, there are funds in the system. We're paying, I don't know, what's a group home cost in Toronto now? $195 a day? Is that a reasonable
probably
number, guys?
Twice that,
per person?
Actually.
Per person.
For a group
mm-hmm.
home, yeah, you're up over $200.
I mean, we're spending better than $75,000 a year just to put people in group homes. So the system has resources if we can free it up and give the workers and the executive directors the tools to move stuff around.
Let me find out from our younger guests whether or not your impressions are the same as Meredith Martin's. Meredith produced this program today. She invited all of you to be on. She attended the hearings, and she came away feeling or observing, I guess is a better way to put it, that the clients, which I guess is you guys, didn't have enough time with caseworkers, bounced around from caseworker to caseworker, and when you did see a caseworker, the caseworker seemed overwhelmed at the least and exhausted maybe at the most. Shannon, does that sound right?
I was going to say, I think there definitely needs to be improvements in the overall system. And again, focusing on the outcomes of individualistic needs, because we are human beings. We are all different. We all need different, we have different needs. And I do think there is a challenge with social workers that they sometimes do have big, I shouldn't call us, well, they're called caseloads, right? They have a lot of...
How do you like being thought of as a caseload?
I know. That's how it is, though, in reality. So I think it's a challenge, and I think it's something that needs to be looked into. But overall, focusing on the outcomes of improving those youth and their individualistic needs.
AJ, what was your experience in dealing with a caseworker?
I actually was one of the fortunate ones in which I didn't bounce around from caseworker to caseworker, but I felt like my caseworker didn't have enough time for me. He actually told me at one point that I think he had 30 clients scattered all over the province, and sometimes it took him a day just to commute back and forth for, you know, a 1 to 2 hour meeting. And it turns out I only saw him 4 to 5 times a year. And something that really affected me was that he only seemed to ever get a call when I was having a bad day or was going through an emotional crisis. He never got a call to say, AJ got an A+ at school today, or, you know, we're celebrating the fact that AJ stuck with the job for 3 months.
So his impression of you is skewed.
I would believe so, yeah. And I mean, it just, yeah, it always felt like he had a negative impression of me or was always looking down at me.
Did you like him?
I didn't have a very good relationship with him. He was the one who was legally responsible for me, and the thing about it was he didn't feel like a parent. I realized that the group home workers and the foster parents were the ones that had the day-to-day interaction, but I definitely felt like he had a negative impression of me because the only paperwork or phone calls he ever seemed to get about me were negative ones. Mm. And I felt like more could have been done to have a better relationship and a positive relationship with the person who had to sign for me.
Ian?
Really important issue here, and it's and I think also at the hearings we heard a lot about workers, and we also heard a lot of really positive stories about from young people about their workers, but the theme was we would really like to be able to spend more time with our workers. And just as Shanna and AJ have said, and not just when they have to fill in forms, and not just when they have deadlines that they have to meet for the system's needs. So this is, we've had a number of CASs have looked at this a lot, and there are some studies that a group of CASs have done that are saying that today, the workers who are professionally trained to spend time supporting kids like AJ and Shanna are spending 25%, maybe 30% of their time with kids and families. And that's what,
30%.
As a province, that's what we want them spending their time doing. But they
so,
only
sorry, what are they doing with the rest of the 70%?
Well, now some of it, AJ talked about being 16 placements all over the province. So as you heard AJ say, some of it is driving. Now some of that's unavoidable, mm-hmm. but that's a part of the equation of just where are the kids and how easy are they to get to. It's better for you to be close to home, and it's better for your
but
worker.
But it's also wherever the beds are because of lack of resources.
Right. Mm-hmm. And another big piece, and probably I think if you asked any frontline worker, their first answer would be they're doing paperwork. Their car is in the parking lot at the CAS, and they're doing paperwork. And again, to be fair, I think we all understand that, you know, there's a lot of risks facing our kids when they come into care. We don't want this to be without rules and without paperwork. We talked about outcomes. That's important. Our view is it can be a lot less paperwork. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of redundancy of the paperwork that's there. There's a lot of paperwork. I suspect the two of you would agree that in some respects just add to the stigma and the reminder mm-hmm. that you're a kid in care.
And I had a
sorry, the one thing I was going to say is, so if we just a 10% reduction in the amount of paperwork that your workers are doing across the province would free up 1.2 million hours of frontline staff time to spend with kids.
Now, when this works well, I guess the caseworker, or what do you call them? What's their title?
Caseworker. Yeah.
They can be a wonderful mentor, presumably, for the
There's no question that for many young people, the caseworker is their consistent adult mentor, coach, as close to a parent as can be if they don't have a good relationship with a foster parent or someone. But, you know, I do think it goes back to some of what Will was talking about, and that is trying to, it's not going to work so well for AJ and Shanna, but for some of the younger kids that that are either not even in the system yet or are already in the system, how can we set them up through either adoption or working things through with their own family, even if they can't live there, so that they do have these adult connections that that can be there for them? Because a caseworker will have anywhere from 17 to 27 cases, and they're in the business because they care about you, but it's impossible.
Are we, Will, asking the caseworkers to be mother, father, bureaucrat, best friend, older brother, older sister? I mean, it sounds like they're having to bear a heavy load.
Well, the caseworkers, of course, have a basic set of responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Many of them go well beyond that and become the adult in their lives. But I think the consistent theme you're hearing is that just as any kid who's maturing, Crown wards need to have an adult in their life. And that adult can be a caseworker, it can be an adoptive parent. And you know, moving from foster to adoptive is very important because it means your chances of disrupting the placement later, having the placement break down, is much less. But it can be some unusual people, right? It can be the teacher or the person down the street. I know one young girl whose adult in her life is the coach at the riding stable that she rides at. And she, you know, is the barn hand there. And that's the adult relationship in her life. And, I think it's an adult relationship that will carry this young woman through into equine college and beyond, and has really made a huge difference. So where that adult comes from can be any number of things. You know, AJ mentioned kinship. I think there's a program in Brooklyn called You Gotta Believe that Pat O'Brien runs that just is focused on that issue. Getting an adult into the kid's life so that when the normal things that happen to 16 to 25-year-olds happen, and they're going to happen, we've got someone there.
Hmm. And I would add, so the theme here, which came through so strongly at the hearings, was about that desire for adult connections to carry into adulthood. And if you think of it, for any of us, we've carried multiple adult relations into adulthood. Right. So part of what we need to look at the system is, where are the opportunities early on, later on, to grow and create and enable those relationships? Because it's not, and I think we said it, it's not just the caseworker, it's not just the foster parents. And what are the circumstances to create it? And again, I appreciated, AJ, your story with the multiple moves, because as Steve picked up on, it's just really hard to create lifelong relationships when you move that much.
Shanna, did you have sort of an adult in your life who you could look to as a quasi-parent, mentor, whatever?
Yeah, I did, actually. Not one specific. I had multiple different times. I feel like I always say the saying, like, people, you get the people that you need, not the people necessarily that you want. Like, those people, like, I was lucky enough to have those people in my life. But I think it's important that we realize that, like, the outcomes that have been shown in the statistics show that it's not, what's happening right now is not working. Hmm. It needs to be changed.
How about your caseworker? Did you have one or many?
My caseworker that I have now, I would say I have a really good relationship with. I had multiple.
Was it difficult to establish?
I felt like I had some relationship, but it's challenging. It doesn't feel real, I guess.
Did you feel that group of people, or, you know, as you went through the system, were genuinely interested in what happened to you?
It's their job. They are interested, obviously. They're interested in you, but they don't always listen to you. And I don't feel like they always listen to what
you need. Can you give me an example of that?
Well, there was a time where I did ask to get moved out of my foster home because I was having a very challenging relationship. And I was just told, wait it out. You have until you're 18 and you can leave.
And how
old
were you?
I was told that for 2 years.
For 2 years? Waited out for 2 years.
And I did. Say it was a challenging high school experience.
And you waited it out for the 2 years?
Yes.
My goodness. Was there a part of you that thought, this person really is doing their best, but they're just overwhelmed?
Actually, that's what I always bring it down to. I always say maybe it's for my own comfort, but I say, you know what, they're really overwhelmed. They have a bunch of cases. But then I step back and I think, is that fair? I'm a case, and I... I'm a case, and I'm just thrown aside because I'm really busy. Hmm. That's not really fair.
Will, politics, as you well know, is about the art of the possible. What's possible here?
You know, every time I see kids like Shanna and AJ and the kids who presented at the hearings, we simply need to do everything we can for these 8,300 kids who we are parents of. This is not a place to be short-termist about this. Ben was on the show the other day, said that every kid who spends an additional year in education is about $10,000.
Ben Levin.
Yeah. And, you know, there's lots of money here in the system. New minister has a new mandate and a new opportunity to really move this, building on great work by Laurel Broughton, who was the previous minister, who was now promoted to education. We actually, in the art of the possible here, Steve, we've had some great ministers here. We had Deb Matthews, we've had Laurel Broughton, we've had a few others who are no longer in politics.
This is and now we have Child and Youth Services?
Child and Youth Services. Okay. And Eric Hoskins, by all reports, is a really first-rate guy. So I think we've got an opportunity in Ontario around this cabinet table for this government to step up and make some stuff happen.
You know what we've also got? $16 billion deficit, $240 billion debt.
But Deb Matthews and Laurel Broughton are the places that are the big spenders. I think if you went to those two hat in hand and said, Deb and Laurel, can we have a little bit of money for these kids, that they would both get that.
Yeah, and then they go to Dwight Duncan, and Dwight Duncan would say, $16 billion deficit, $240 billion debt.
How about if we take the 3% down to 2.9 and take that little 0.1
from
health and education?
But you can't put a price on a child's life.
Yeah. And that's another thing. I don't think it's always just about the money either. I mean, the Office of the Provincial Advocate has really been focusing on a whole government approach. And what can all the ministries bring to the table? How can Ministry of Transportation help? And it doesn't always come down to money. Like, we were just saying, it's connections, it's resources. I know a lot of people see it as money, but it's not about money. It's not necessarily money. It comes down to other
resources.
No, I hear you. And it's not, but we can get better at spending the money we have to do better. And we've got lots of positive evidence to build on. So right now we spend 56% of our money in child welfare on kids who are in care. We know that the places where they do the best is actually usually in the least expensive settings, the ones that are most family-liked, whether that is through an adoption placement, a legal custody placement, or a regular foster care. Mm-hmm. We know that's where kids do best, and they do even better if they're with kin, and even better if they're at home. Depending on the circumstances, there are exceptions. And we have lots of evidence that how do we get kids in those placements, the places where they can thrive, do the best, grow their roots, and develop the relationships they need. We have a lot of evidence about how to do that well and how to spend our money so that we're doing the most good with what we can.
Well, let me follow up with Mary on this, because I know it's not all about money, but it's a bit about money. And
there's no question.
And I want to ask you about whether you believe there is a perception out there that foster parents, I don't know what percentage, but some of them are in it for the money. They want that stipend. Will's shaking his head.
You can't see me, but I'm shaking my head too. But go ahead.
But is that perception out there?
Well, the job that foster parents do for the children in Ontario that can't be cared for in their own homes, there are the exceptions. But really, they are exceptional people. They have children coming into their home that have had multiple issues, sometimes in the middle of the night, and they go to great lengths to really do their very best to take care of them.
AJ, I want to hear from AJ on this. Did you think any of your foster parents along the road were in it for the money?
I had one foster parent tell me that directly. That they were in it for the money. I'm not saying this reflects all foster parents, and I'm not saying that this reflects the experience of all 8,300 Crown wards and all foster children, but I do know that I spoke to one foster parent and said, why are you really doing this? And she said to me, I'm a darn good parent to my own children. I don't get paid to be a parent, so why not be a darn good parent to someone else's children whose parents aren't there for them and get paid for it too?
How much do they pay, do you know?
I'm not familiar with that. I know it's not a lot, but what I do want to say, though, is that she's no longer a foster parent. I have confirmed that. But, and I mean, there are added expenses. Raising a child is not cheap, and I've already raised that. But when you're solely in it for the dollar signs, that's wrong.
Okay, Shan, I saw you shaking your head, though. Was that
I was just going to say, I'm not going to shed light on my experience, but reflecting the 8,300, we all have different experience. Again, it comes down that we're individuals, and I think that some foster homes, there has been good connections, and in the hearings, people did say they had good relationships, but there is also the lack of light that needs to be shined on those foster homes that there isn't good experiences.
But did you ever get the sense that some of your foster parents along the way were just in it for the money?
Yes, most definitely.
You did get that sense. Okay, so I'm hearing from the people who run the system that no, it's not the case. And I'm hearing from two people who you know, who've been on the receiving end of it say, well, actually, yes, it is. Okay, back to you.
Okay. I think what I was saying, in any profession, in any job, in any work that people do, you're going to get people that are in it, maybe not for the right reasons. But the money that they are paid to a large extent is to cover the expenses of having the children there.
Can you give us a sense of how much it is?
I probably shouldn't.
You know, Will?
Sure. I got $14.50 a day in the U.S. and $32.50 in Canada is my recollection of it.
Yeah. What did you think of the amount?
We clearly weren't doing it for the money. I don't think most people do it for the money. I think that there are people who are parenting who make the decision that rather than taking a job outside of the home, that they'll add foster children to the mix, and that'll help defray some expenses. I do think, absolutely, except that goes on. I will say, I've known some really excellent foster parents. I mean, people who are among the sainted people that I've ever met in my life.
Well, you know, Michelle Bachmann, who's running for president of the United States now, when asked to talk about herself, often says, you know, had 5 children biologically and 22 or 25 foster kids as well.
There's another really important part of the foster parent story, and that is the need to support foster parents.
Right.
So as Mary said, it's challenging having, and it's more challenging for kids coming into a home in which they're strangers, but it is challenging as a parent. Will and I know this as adoptive parents of supporting kids who haven't been in your life since they were infants. And so when you talk to foster parents about how can we do a better job for kids, one of the things they'll say is sometimes we need more supports. And the moves, talking about the multiple moves, sometimes those multiple moves are happening because we don't do well enough as a system at bringing supports to the home. We move the kid to a place where more supports are available as opposed to bringing supports for the home. Sometimes we don't do well enough supporting foster parents who are putting out the white flag saying, I need help. I need more money for a babysitter once a week so that my husband and I or my sister and I can get time to go away and just to get a breather. So no one's perfect, and you'll find imperfect people in every quarter of life. But we have to look at, if we want kids to be in stable homes that have relationships they can carry into adulthood that feel good and positive, how do we support those people?
Well, let me follow. I have just a few minutes left here, and I want to, AJ, let me start this with you. It sounds like a good adoption would address a lot of those issues. You know, you're not going from house to house to house. You actually are part of a family. You feel part of a family. That sounds like a good solution. Was that ever an option for you along the way?
It was explored, but I was such a broken child that no one wanted me. So.
But you would you have been open to that or have wanted that?
I didn't have much of a say in it. I mean, I was only 12 years old. I know that it was. There was foster parents who were open to the idea, but I think I had such a good connection with my mom that I didn't want to lose that, because the theory behind it was that if I was adopted, CAS wanted to sever that connection until I was 18, and my mom and I were both very vocal that even though we didn't have the strongest relationship, we wanted them to put resources in to strengthening that relationship rather than strengthening a relationship with someone who wasn't my biological parent.
Yeah, we're going to make the same point. That's one of the legislative changes that has now happened, along with the removing of the economic barriers. We have a real shortage of both foster parents and adoptive parents for older kids, particularly in the city of Toronto. And people really need to think about this in their own personal situation and think about whether it's something that they could do. Because part of what we're talking about here, part of the problem, is that we're sending a lot of kids to Oshawa and to
Wasaga Beach
because we can't find parents in the city of Toronto proper who are willing to foster and adopt.
What would be different about 416 folks that they don't want to do this more than anybody else?
I don't know the answer to that, Steve. It may be in part that we have more kids coming into care. Mary, do you know?
Well, I think there's a number of different reasons. Actually, foster parents around the province of Ontario, it's becoming more and more difficult to find them. When you've got two parents working away from home, there's the change in that demographic. The size of people's home, just being able to accommodate families, accommodate more children. When you're moving into the downtown parts of Toronto, you've got, smaller accommodation. So there's a large number of issues that, okay. And it's also very difficult.
I'm down to my last minute here, and I want to give it to you.
I was just going to say, I think it's important to recognize that there's not one solution. Adoption's not a solution.
Right. Yep,
money is not a solution. And I think the report that's coming out from the youth that spoke at the hearings will shed a lot of light, and all these people will be contributing their thoughts and their ideas. And I think it's important that people still make submissions, and the submissions you're able to make until January 3rd, and then people can still, what they think, the recommendations that they should be, because I think the government is responsible. There's no one answer, and I think that's what really needs to focus
on. But the people of Ontario also need to start speaking up, and because their tax dollars are the ones that are going to pay for the quality of the care that Crown wards are receiving. So I think the taxpayers, now that they're watching this program and seeing all the media coverage, they need to speak up and say, I don't want my tax dollars to fund a system the way that it currently is. Because we're all sitting at the table acknowledging that there's a problem here. We just may bring different solutions to the table.
I want to thank all of you for coming in tonight and helping us with this discussion. Ian Underwood, the Commission to Promote Sustainable Welfare, on the left-hand side of the table. Will Falk, the Executive Fellow at the Mowat Center, and Mary Ballantyne from the Ontario Association of Children's Aid Societies. And if I may say, last and certainly not least, Arthur Gallant and Shanna Allen. We thank you for coming in and sharing your stories with us, your wisdom, and we wish you all the luck in the world
going
forward.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.